All right, thank you so much, Surya. And thanks everyone for being here. And I hope you enjoy this talk. So what I'm going to tell you about today is some work joint with Matthew Yu, who is here, about, well, it's a computational question. So I'm often interested in questions of anomaly cancellation in physics, which in many cases boil down to a computation in mathematics of some things called Bordism groups. So the first thing that I'm going to say is, well, what is this story? This story is like, it's relatively well traveled as far as paths go. And so I'll just walk through, okay, well, there's sort of a standard program. What do you do? What are each of the steps? What do they look like? So, you know, rather than getting into the gory details, it's just what does each step of the argument feel like? Where can you go to learn more? Now, it turns out that this standard path doesn't always work. And so then what I will tell you is, okay, well, what happens when this fails? Why does it fail? And what is an example, like, in some sense, abstractly, if you asked a mathematician about this, they would have said, okay, yeah, sure, there are some examples where, you know, where you might come up with a Tom spectrum that doesn't come from a vector bundle. But like, those are kind of, you know, all the way over there. They're like abstract, weird counterexamples. But it turns out, no, these show up in physics applications. So I'm going to talk to you about not just what can go wrong, but where it shows up in questions that you might care about. For example, in applications to string theory or supergravity. And then, well, how do you fix it? So there's still a concrete question, which is, can we compute the Bordism groups corresponding to these weird twists that we didn't know how to fit into the standard picture? And, you know, maybe can we do so without having to work too hard? And so that is the big theorem of this talk, the main theorem. And so that's what Matt and I proved and are currently writing up. And so that's in the last part of the talk, that's more mathematical, that's what I'll tell you about. So I've done my best to, I tried to think about what would be the best level to pitch this talk at. So if things are too easy or too hard, please let me know and I can adjust on the fly. So the goal is anomaly cancellation. Or maybe I should start this differently. So let's say that you wanted to find a quantum field theory at a physical level where they're not necessarily mathematical. So in the process of defining a quantum field theory, there can be a mild inconsistency. Called an anomaly. And so the way that this shows up, you know, it's not like there's some clear hallmark of like, this is exactly what an anomaly is and here it is, but it's typically some sort of inconsistency, it's mild. And as an example of how you might see it, you know, partition functions, instead of just being defined on the manifold, they depend on some extra data to get a number. And otherwise, you know, your partition function is in some complex line that hasn't been trivialized. So one-dimensional complex vector space, not trivialized. And okay, fine. So you trivialize it, except you want to do this in sort of a uniform way on all manifolds to get numbers out. But then there's some ambiguity, or maybe you can't do this uniformly for all manifolds in space-time dimension. And that's when you have an anomaly. So I want to hedge before I continue, which is if you ask four mathematical physicists what an anomaly is, I bet you'll get at least five answers. So I have my approach to anomalies, which works in many cases, but is certainly not universal. And so for example, if you cared about like, I think conformal anomalies are one of the classes that this doesn't always say something about. So, you know, this works for many examples, notably for anomalies of fermions, but not, you know, I'm not making some sort of universality statement. So what is an anomaly? So the model is that an anomaly So let's say Z is our quantum field theory as an invertible field theory, which I'll say what that is. In one dimension higher. So what does this mean? So the idea here is everything in a quantum field theory should be local and hopefully also unitary. So this alpha of M, this vector space which is not, which we have not been able to make isomorphic to the complex numbers without some additional data, that should be local in M2. You should be able to chop up M and somehow assemble alpha of M from the data of the pieces, like everything else in quantum field theory. And a particularly nice way of saying that is saying that this is the space of states in some quantum field theory. So the idea is that alpha of M is the state space of alpha on M, where this was where the partition function lives. So we'd like to say, okay, this inconsistency goes away, this alpha is trivial. But if we can't do that, then the theory has an anomaly. So I should, in order to do this, I should say what an invertible field theory is. So a field theory is invertible if it has an inverse. So what does that mean? You tensor alpha and alpha inverse, and you get the trivial theory. So this is due to Fried and Moore. Because of who I am, I anchor this firmly in the T.S. Siegel perspective on field theories. And so if you want to make this into a mathematically precise definition, this had better be a topological field theory. But the idea is more general than that, because you're just saying you want to be able to tensor together two field theories and get something trivial. So that ought to exist in multiple models of field theories. For example, if you're, from the perspective of condensed matter physics, this is precisely stacking of phases. And so invertibility is saying is closely related to the notion of an SPT phase. So what was I going to say? You can think of these as almost but not quite trivial theories. So saying that the anomaly is an invertible field theory is saying, well, this thing is close to being trivial. There's an inconsistency, but it's mild. And we'd like to trivialize it and therefore make the anomaly go away. So sometimes anomalies are okay, but in many cases, we want the anomaly to be trivial. So, for example, string theory hopefully is consistent. And there have been a very large number of consistency checks done over the last several decades. And some of them take the form of anomaly cancellation. That is saying, here's an invertible field theory. A priori, it's non-trivial. We're going to show that it is not just trivializable, but it is canonically trivialized. And so, you know, there's various string theoretic techniques and duality saying, okay, well, this one is trivial. Therefore, for string theoretic reasons, we think this other one should also be trivial. And so, you know, checking both of these and then comparing the results is a way of verifying things that we think are true about string theory, but maybe don't have a whole lot of, mathematical evidence for. You could say, okay, well, I want to test the string duality. Let's compute things on both sides. And anomalies are one example of that. So how do we do this? Well, there's different ways. And what I'm going to tell you is one way that is not the only way. So one approach is invertible field theories in a given dimension form an abelian group. And the idea is that if you have an invertible theory and another invertible theory, you can tensor them together and it's still invertible. So, or you could, you know, stacking of SPT phases, if those words help. So, so find generators, calculate the size, or sorry, maybe a way to say it is, maybe this group is zero. And so there's no anomaly. So as an example, Ed Winton studied E8 cross E8 heterotic string theory in a certain setting and said, okay, this is the relevant, here's, so he said it in different language, but he ended up showing that the group of invertible field theories that control the anomaly is just the zero group. So without even having to know anything more about the theory, there's no anomaly. Or we can find, you know, we can use the structure of this group to assist in anomaly cancellation. So for example, maybe your group is Z mod 2, and you say, okay, I have this anomaly in vertible field theory. And for reasons specific to the theory, you know, I'll show an example of this in a little bit. I know that this anomaly is twice some other invertible field theory. So then you go and you compute and you say, oh, the group's Z mod 2, so 2 is equal to 0. And that's that, now you've canceled your anomaly. Great. So, so this approach follows a fairly standard path. So what I'm going to do next is I'm going to tell you how that path goes. And again, it's not going to be, here's exactly all the computational details, but okay, this is the step, this is what it looks like, here's where you can read more. First, are there any questions? Okay. So the key fact is due to Fried, Hopkins, Telemann, consistent orientations of moduli spaces, and then Fried, Hopkins. And this is the big reflection positivity paper that says the abelian group of invertible field theories in dimension n. And so, okay, you need to specify a little bit more. What kinds of, so you need a structure on your manifold, right? Like a spin structure if you have fermions. And so that's gonna be a little bit implicit in here, but I'll say it more precisely later. Let's see. So what's a good way to say it? This abelian group of invertible field theories is isomorphic to a Bordism group. Or maybe let me be a little more vague, to a group built from Bordism classes of n and n plus one manifolds. So I'm going to say what this is in a bit. But in the meantime, the point, so Bordism is something that algebraic topologists have studied for a long time. There are tools. I like to think of it as they've sort of been, for years and years and years, they've been sharpening their knives, working on these very hard problems in pure homotopy theory. And all of a sudden, you have this, like, this problem in physics, and they're ready to attack. So the upshot is that this is amenable to standard tools. Oh, I should use that eraser. So how does that look? Let's go here. Oops. So what's the procedure? So the procedure for Bordism theoretic anomaly cancellation . So step zero is make sure the perturbative part of the anomaly is zero. So this approach of two anomalies, you know, studying them via invertible field theories and the Fried-Hopkins, Telemann, and Fried-Hopkins classifications, these are all non-perturbative. So I personally like that because, I mean, I don't know a lot of perturbation theory, but also, okay, we physicists and mathematical physicists have these nice tools for dealing with perturbative parts of anomalies. It's like, okay, it's pretty straight. Like there's sort of a machine, you study it. So that part's relatively understood. So this part zero, in an example that you're looking at, this part zero is often find the paper that did this in like the 80s and then cite it. But then it's nice to have this non-perturbative part because, like, you know, these two methods, they're quite different. They're complementary. And you know, when you take two complementary things and add them together, it's right. Just like complementary angles. So we want to make sure that the perturbative part of the anomaly is zero, and then we continue. And like I said, that's often citing. So while we're doing that, let's walk through with an example. How legible is this color? Okay. Wait, is it really? Oh, okay, it's much better back here. So I'm gonna explain. So for each of the steps, I'm gonna say roughly what does this look like for this specific example. Oh no. So this example is the U-duality symmetry of four-dimensional n equals 8 supergravity. So this is also a joint work with Matt from last year. So what is going on in this example? So this is a four-dimensional theory, so the anomaly should be a five-dimensional invertible field theory. It's gonna be an anomaly four. Well, there's a symmetry by this group called E77Z. So E7 is the, there's a Lie algebra E7, simple complex Lie algebra in that classification. You take its split real form, and then you take the integer version of that. So this is a symmetry, and we're gonna say, okay, if you turn on that symmetry, is there an anomaly? Now, it turned out that what Matt and I did is actually different. We looked at a simpler problem, which is where we replace this with its real points. This is believed to act on the supergravity theory. This is sort of the more fundamental one, but it's there as far as we can tell. And this problem is currently intractable because we don't know enough about the cohomology of this group. Whereas this group, its cohomology of its classifying space rather, that's something that we understand. So we were able to use this and address this anomaly cancellation question. We hope to return to this one in future work. So I'm just gonna use this as an example of, like, you know, how the story goes. The story, like I said, you know, it's straight. It's a thing that's been done in a lot of papers. It uses a lot of tools that are well established in mathematics. And so I'll just use this example to say, okay, here's what it looks like in this concrete example. So for example, for U-duality, this was a computation done a long time ago. So, great. This has the consequence, by the way. So this implies, once you've killed the perturbative part, that the anomaly field theory is topological. And so this is nice because this means that the tools of mathematics give you theorems rather than necessarily conjectures. And so it's good that is a good thing. So now we know that we have this mysterious non-perturbative part of the anomaly, and we'd like to figure out what it is. So the first step is to ask what kinds of manifolds does our quantum field theory, our supergravity theory, what kind of manifolds does our theory make sense on? So what do we have? So for U-duality, so what are the fields of 4D n equals 8 supergravity? So how does this game work? Is you say, okay, what are the fields? What's the symmetry? Like what is the most general manifold on which these things can be consistently defined? So for example, if you have fermions, you better have something like a spin structure. So, but the something like a spin structure is sort of where all the interesting things happen. So there's a spin 2 particle, there's some spin 3 halves particles, there's a vector boson, which is spin 1, there's some fermions, and there is a scalar field. In fact, usually people say there's quite a lot of scalar fields, but you can sort of bundle them together into one piece. All right, thanks for coming. So, okay, so we should expect something like a spin structure because we have these half integer spin particles. We also want to put in the E77 symmetry. So before we do that, I'm going to make one more simplification. Which is the following. So we can replace E77 with its maximal compact. SU8. So a topological field theory is some sort of functor on some sort of Bordism category that is topological and not geometric. And what that means is that basically anything that you can do in a topological field theory is insensitive to the inclusion, the homotopy equivalence, which is a maximal compact, including into a non-compact Lie group. So if you set up the Bordism category for manifolds with this kind of structure, or even twisted like we're going to see, it's actually equivalent to the one for SU8. Now, one caveat which I should mention, which is that the maximal compact of this is actually SU8 mod Z2. So let's make this thing into its universal cover. Just so that we can, just so that we know we always have that, and then we're going to figure out exactly what form of the group we get later. So, okay, E77R, really it's double cover, and then we get SU8. And we can do that because it's topological. So how does SU8 act? So here, SU8 acts trivially. Here, these fields are valued in, let's see, it's lambda 3, so the third exterior power of the fundamental representation of SU8. Here, they act in lambda 2. Here, they just act in lambda 1. And then on the scalar field, they act, the scalar field is a coset, which ultimately, it's not gonna come into play in this story. So it's there, you can look at it, but it's not relevant for this anomaly cancellation story. So what do we discover? So we have so because we have fermions, we better get spin. So the symmetry group, spin 4 times SU8. And you'll notice, it's really SU8. It's not the adjoint form, because this representation is faithful. So we can't say, okay, well, it's like SU8 mod, the eighth roots of unity or something. So that's an idea, but this is not the full story. So we're gonna make the symmetry group a little bit better. So what I would say is, notice that minus 1, 1, and 1, minus 1 in this group always act the same . So, specifically, we're looking at these three, because, okay, trivial, or let's say these four. So, minus 1 in spin 4 acts on bosons trivially, and fermions by minus 1. Minus 1 in SUA acts trivially here, here. Here it acts non-trivially, Here it acts trivially because minus 1 squared. Here it acts non-trivially because minus 1 cubed. So in these cases, you get, let me draw it. You get plus plus, you get minus minus, plus plus, minus minus, plus plus. So in other words, we can actually quotient to a smaller symmetry group, which sounds weird. We want larger symmetry groups. But this is good, because what this is saying is that the sum of these two, or the difference of these two elements is redundant. So let's quotient out by it so we have a better symmetry group. So the correct symmetry group is the quotient spin 4 times SU8 mod plus minus 1. So I'm typically going to refer to this as spin SU8. And so the point is this thing is actually what acts. So manifolds with this structure. So 40 n equals 8 sugra can be put on manifolds with this structure. I should put an asterisk here because look, we're in Euclidean signature and not Minkowski signature. But for the purposes of studying anomalies, we wanted to Wick rotate anyway, so this is fine. Okay, so that's good. And now, now I can precisely state these theorems. We want the Fried-Hopkins one. So theorem the group of n-dimensional reflection positive. I'll say the purpose why we have this extra adjective in a sec. Invertible topological field theories on manifolds with spin SU8 structure . So we're looking for manifolds where the structure group, which is a priori ON or O4 or SO4, can be lifted to this. So a spin structure does it, but an orientation not necessarily on its own. But the key point is this is more general than just a spin structure. So actually, let me mention this. So for example, the Enrique surface is a manifold which has this spin SU8 structure, but is not spin. So that's the quotient of a K3 by a free involution, free orientation preserving involution. So we care about manifolds with this structure. And what we get, the Bordesen group is isomorphic to the torsion subgroup of Hans from, I'll say what this is, in just a sec, C star. So this is a Bordesen group. I'm going to define it in just a sec. And the point is that we get the torsion subgroup of the sort of characters of that group. So this is an abelian group. We get another abelian group. And that's invertible field theories. So these are the things which topology is, you know, topologists have been calculating for years. Decades, rather. So I think the next thing I should say what this Bordesen group is. Before I do that, are there any questions? Yeah. So what this means, okay, so let's start here. So spin cross SU8 is saying you have a spin structure and you have a principal SU8 bundle. This is saying that if you ask how does spin flip act on the spinners here and how does minus 1 act on the total space of the SU8 bundle, we've identified those somehow. So you take a quotient by that. Does that answer your question? So actually, as a good example, if you replace SU8 with U1, this is the same. This is the that's a spin C structure. So this is like a generalization of that.
Yeah. So like some group structure, means just principal bundle.
Yeah, thanks for asking. Who's got more questions?
I mean, you're also like requiring that if you think about it all as one big bundle for that group, and then you mod out by the SUK, you're getting the tangible.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly right. So it's a bundle for, oops, sorry. So the precise definition then is a bundle for this group, such that when you take the associated spin four, like you quotient down to SO, then you get the bundle of oriented frames. Yeah, great. More questions before I go on.
Another question, I'm not putting the point here. So is it some transcendental thing to compute this omega n spin four across
the space? Wait, sorry, you said is it like tractable? Oh, this is very computable.
Okay.
Sort of the whole point of this talk is like ways of computing this. But I'll say more about that in just a moment, actually. Yeah. Because first I should say what it is, and then I'll say how it's computed. Yeah. In fact, it's Z2. But we'll get there. I mean, n is 5 in that case, because that's one relevant for anomaly cancellation. So omega n. Oh, I should probably mention, I stated this theorem in a certain way, but this theorem works for an arbitrary G structure here. Like it's quite general. This is the only thing that we need today, but like their theorem is, it works for arbitrary groups. So this is the abelian group of Bordism classes of n-dimensional spin SU8 manifolds. So to it, what is this? This is, so let's take all diffeomorphism classes of closed n-dimensional spin SU8 manifolds. So that's some set. If you want to worry about set theoretic issues, there's a way around it. And this is a commutative monoid under disjoint union. And now let's mod out by the manifolds, which are boundaries of compact n plus one dimensional spin SU8 manifolds. The quotient, a priori a commutative monoid, is actually an abelian group. It's finitely generated. If you replace spin SU8 with pretty much anything that's reasonable, say any compact Lie group, you're always going to get some finitely generated abelian groups. So as an example, just as a picture, so this is saying S1, the boundary of this surface, is 0 in the relevant Bordism group. And really, we'd want to say spin SU8 structures here and here, but the idea of Bordism is to say when you are a boundary, that manifold becomes 0. So that's what that group is. And so now, returning to your question, how do we compute? Well, we want to compute omega 5. How do we compute the fifth spin SU8 Bordism group? So this has been mathematicians have been computing Bordism groups for a long, long time, going back to the 50s. And so if you have a structure which is like not too wonky, so like oriented, spin, honestly even like string, pin plus, something that people have thought about, then you can just look it up. Like, you ask someone who knows these things and you say, hey, do you know if these have been done? And they say, oh yeah. Here's this picture from like, this paper from like 1981, here's your answer. But this group was not in the literature. So we have to compute it. So that's the next step. Let's see. So let me say how that goes. So this next step is sometimes called shearing. And I want to say you can do without, but this is a simplification step. There are math tools that sort of attack this generally, and the problem is quite complicated. But what we'd like to do is we'd like to say, okay, let's simplify this dramatically into things that there are already standard tools for, and then go from there. So step one, find a representation V of, let me write this a little differently. So we can think of, so spin SU8, comes from the following central extension. So we'd like to think of this as a central extension by fermion parity. So this is what acts on bosons. SU8 mod plus minus 1, this is what acts on fermions. So in this setting, so this is classified by class beta in H2 of B SU8 mod plus minus 1. So standard group extension thing, plus minus 1 is Z2. So the standard theorems say if you can find, or sorry, let me word it differently. So step one, find a representation of the bosonic group let's call this representation rho with the second Stiefel-Whitney class of rho equal to beta. So first you do this, and then a general theorem implies that omega star spin SU8 is naturally isomorphic to something. So I need to say what these things are. So let's do that. So this is just, so this object is what's called a Tom spectrum. And a Tom spectrum is nice because if you have a Tom spectrum for a representation, or rather of its associated vector bundle, these are good. There are nice formulas for the cohomology. So that's something called the Tom isomorphism. And then the Stiefel-Whitney classes of your vector bundle twist with some additional information. This is spinbornism. So I'll say more about that in a sec. But the point is, you have a representation theory question. Let's look through the representations of SU8 mod plus minus 1. Let's find one which is the correct W2, and then we're good to go. So W2 is the obstruction to being spin. And this is where it matters that we have SU8 mod plus minus 1. Because SU8 being simply connected, every representation of it lifts to spin. But SU8 mod plus minus 1, well, it's not simply connected. So we have hope of finding this kind of thing. So what do we do? Well, so omega star spin of stuff is fairly straightforward. So you can use the atoms or a Tia Herzebruch spectral sequence. Let me see how much time I have. I have enough time. And then for a Tom spectrum, the inputs to these spectral sequences are easy to determine. From the cohomology of X and the Stiefel-Whitney classes of V. So remember, in this case, X is the classifying space of this group. Nice, compactly group, quotient of SU8 mod plus minus 1. So like, as far as compactly groups go in, like, that aren't too big, this one is like not the easiest, but it's like pretty straightforward. It's a question, you figure out the answer. The Stiefel-Whitney classes of this, likewise, all we need our W1, which has to vanish because SU8 mod Z2 is connected, and W2, which we already know. So we're good to go. And so now there's the question of when you actually run the spectral sequence, what happens? But the atom spectral sequence for spin bornism in physically relevant dimensions is not so hard. So in this case, what do you end up getting? So let me draw that. So I'll draw the E2 page. It turns out to collapse at E2. I'll explain what all of these things are. So each one of these towers, you know, this is sort of like beanstalk floating off to infinity, is a Z in bornism. So we get omega 0 is Z, and these are all spin SU8. Omega 1, 2, 3 is 0. Omega 4 is Z squared. And finally, this dot right here is a Z2. So we get, like I mentioned, the group controlling anomalies is Z2. And so you might ask, could there be differentials here? But there's a standard theorem due to Margolis that says, no, there can't be in this case, because of the way that this came into the spectral sequence. So then you conclude, and then you say, okay, great, we have our bornism group. And like I mentioned, the erase is over there. We can use this to do anomaly cancellation. So I'm going to tell that story very quickly. And then Matt and I showed the anomaly for U-duality is 2 times some other invertible field theory. So, okay, it's 2 times something in Z2. And so we conclude the anomaly for the E77R symmetry is 0. Good. This is something we wanted to be true. String theory ought to be consistent. So this passed a consistency check. Now, this is the first part of the talk. Now I need to tell you what changes in the case of non-vector bundle twists. But first, does anyone notice anything wrong? So I just assumed that we could find a representation with this condition. And okay, plausibility check. This thing has a pi 1, so of course there should be non-spin representations. But it turns out, and this is weird, that it doesn't. So when Matt and I were writing this paper, we said, okay, we think a representation exists. Let's come back and check later. And then we spent quite some time looking for it, looking through, you know, the giant PDF of all the representations, playing around with roots and things. And it turns out, this fact, we learned this fact from David Speyer. Every representation of SU8 mod plus minus 1 admits a spin structure. So again, a priori, this is surprising because this is not simply connected. But so, okay, this is cool, but this is bad because this whole technique, this standard technique that is used in like all these anomaly cancellation papers, we can't use it. And so what Matt and I did was we found a more complicated workaround. So that's not so fun, where you say, okay, you know, instead of taking this shortcut to do this, you have to work over the entire Steenrod algebra, things are much more complicated. I mean, you can do it, it's unpleasant. But what you end up learning is something that we thought was really interesting. You do this more complicated workaround because this thing is not true, but starting from the E2 page, of the atom spectral sequence, the computation is exactly the same. So, you can't do this, but you get the right answer anyways. And then we looked through more examples. And it seemed always true that even when you can't shear, if you just forgot about that fact and pretended that everything was okay, you get the right answer. But every time we saw that, it came courtesy of some much more complicated argument. That was the impetus for the main theorem that I want to tell you, which, well, essentially says that, you know, we've proved that this works in all cases. So maybe the theorem, so and then this is the heuristic version. So even when the twist doesn't come from a vector bundle, or a representation if you're looking at BG for G a group, so when that's true, when it's not true, you can pretend that it does and get the right answer. So in other words, instead of doing the more complicated thing we did for uduality, you can do the simple one and get a computation that you can really do by hand. And instead of, you know, and then you can do this in other applications. So for example, I'm trying to finish up a paper where I look at E8 cross E8 heterotic string now with the Z2 symmetry that switches the two E8 factors. And that's a version for twisted string borderism where you do the same thing. And instead of having to do something really very complicated, you can work it out essentially again by hand, as if there was a vector bundle. So do I have until 55 or until the hour? Okay, so in that case, I'm gonna say a little bit about the, like some stuff about the math behind this theorem and say a more precise version. Yeah. So the answer is that the differential dr goes one unit to the left and r units up. So the only place it could be interesting is here. Now you can do one of two things. So you can either invoke Margolis's theorem, which says that if you have something coming from a free sumand in over x, then differentials out of it vanish. Alternatively, these vertical lines indicate action by they indicate the action of an algebra on this, and differentials must be equivariant. So here, the action of that element h0 is 0. Here it must be non-zero, so it doesn't commute. So that's one way to do it. Yeah, usually, so Adam's differentials are trivial unless they're very hard. In this case, they're all trivial. Who's got more questions? OK. So how do we do it? So the idea is to use Ando, Blumberg, Gettner, Hopkins, Rez, theory of Tom spectra. So this I will denote Abger, because otherwise I'm going to spend the entire rest of this talk writing those names again. And so this is more general than what we did before. So what they do is they study for R a ring spectrum. If ring spectrum is a sentence that you don't, or is a thing that you're not like super happy with, you can think of this as a cohomology theory, generalized cohomology theory that has a multiplication on it, like K-theory or cohomology. You get rings. So they study a space, BGL1R, you know, such that twists of R theory, where R theory is going to be borderism theory in these examples. So these so twists of R theory on X correspond to maps X to BGL1R. So what you can do is And specifically, so the twisted homology, so the twisted R homology, is equal to the homotopy groups of the Abger Tom spectrum of the twist. So as an example, let's say R is spin Seebordism. So then there's a map, KZ3 to BGL1R. And so the corresponding twisted. So we have a map to KZ3. So given X to KZ3, so a degree 3 cohomology class, C in H3 of XZ, given that, we get a twist of spin Seebordism. And the corresponding twisted spin Seebordism groups are manifolds with a map to X and a trivialization of F star C minus Bach of W2. So a spin C structure is when this is all trivial. You trivialize the Bach sheen of W2. But for a twisted spin C structure, you say Bach W2 is not zero, it's equal to that cohomology class that we wanted. So, okay. So let's put this all together. So using a theorem of Jonathan Beardsley, we found twists of oriented Bordism by first cohomology, spin Seebordism by same thing, and then also H2. So these are not necessarily new. So mostly these twists are not new. And they admit concrete descriptions in terms of characteristic classes like this. This is MT spin C by H1, Z2, H3, Z. And string. And string is an interesting one because we got H1, Z2 like before, and then we got super cohomology. So these map to various other spectra, for example, KO and KU, and these twists then map to the usual twists of KO and KU by, you know, H2Z2, H3Z, the things that people study in twisted K theory normally. The super cohomology, you can get a super cohomology class from a degree 4 cohomology class, and this thing maps to the Andrew-Blumberg-Geppner H4 twist of TMF. So these things, not so new. But the super cohomology twist doesn't seem to have appeared much in the literature. So I don't know, we're curious if there's like some examples of this or interesting computations, like what is that thing? So if that's something you know about or have anything, like if you're curious about, I'd love to hear more about it or talk more about it. So Baker-Lazarev studied a variant of the atom spectral sequence internal to the world of R modules. And so what they established, E2ST, is, I'm going to explain what these are. I don't have much more time, but it won't take much time. So H R star M So ordinarily, if you want to compute, maybe this should be a minus. If you want to compute cohomology, you take maps from your spectrum to an Eilenberg Lane spectrum, and then you take pi star of that, but shifted negative degree because cohomological. Here we're saying let's do that, but let's consider R module maps in the world of ring spectra. And so we say instead of the Steenrod algebra, we have the R module maps from HZ2 to HZ2, and then we take the R module cohomology. So with the last minute or so, I'm going to state the main theorem. So for all of the twists on the rightmost board, we computed HR star of MF, which is the Tom spectrum for the twist, so we computed the input to the Adams spectral sequence. And it is isomorphic to what you would get, or to the formula. You get for twists, the old style, the sort of standard technique, coming from a vector bundle. So I'm out of time. I'm not gonna. So I think I should stop here. But just to summarize, okay, this is the more precise way of saying this, that we have a formula. It's exactly the same as the formula that you get for vector bundle twists in terms of expressing it, in terms of characteristic classes, even when said characteristic classes are not the ones that come from vector bundles. So thanks for listening. Thanks for your time. Sorry for going slightly over. Please let me know if you have questions. Oh, yeah.
So maybe that would be twists on FT, like
oh, good. So this is like crystalline phases or something?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, this is related. So these classifications are some sort of like twisted K theory, right?
Yeah.
So if you don't have crystalline symmetries, then this story is like known, and you replace this with K theory. And that's fine, because there's a map from spin C Bordism to K theory, or spin Bordism to real K theory, which, and this thing is like well understood. But for crystalline symmetries, you're looking at like equivariant twists. So twists of like equivariant cohomology or something. And this is something I honestly, like right now, is something I'm trying to understand better with some friends. And it seems like people know things in the math world that aren't necessarily written down. And that's always a kind of spooky place to be. But in principle, it's possible to use our theorems to compute twisted K theory. But we weren't able, so we actually, we've tried to do that and we haven't found any examples where this technique is more helpful than a T.R. Herzebruch. So if you know of any examples that might be interesting, I'd love to hear them.
I just know that there's this paper by Gobi and Tang where they do compute like twists on K theory specifically.
So wait, sorry, it was Gomi and who'd you say the other author was? Because this is something that sounds, like this sounds like something I should read. Okay, sorry. This is like Kinyomori Gomi?
Maybe while that's getting
sure.
Want to find a representation with a particular W2.
Yes.
That doesn't work out.
Great.
And
yeah.
So, I mean, there should be some kind of generalization of the notion of vector bundle and just like what's getting loosened.
Ah, great. So let's look at spin, because that's the one for you to well. Yeah, sorry, I think I should have clarified this. So in general, we twist spin by vector bundles. And so we say, okay, you have a W1, you have a W2, the other Stefani classes don't matter. Now, instead of a vector bundle, I'm just saying I literally want a pair of cohomology classes. Do they come from a vector bundle? I don't care. You still get the right answer. So for the U-duality case, the W1 piece is zero, and the W2 piece is that cohomology class we wanted but couldn't get from a vector bundle. So we can just proceed as if it was. Is this the question, what you were getting at?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, no, that makes sense. I'm just kind of trying to get some philosophy of what there's really kind of no generalized notion of vector bundle in the picture. There's just this Tom spectrum.
So maybe the correct notion is, so a Tom spectrum, so we think of a vector bundle as the fibers are Rn or Cn. And so from the perspective of homotopy theory, what you can do is you can say, well, let's turn those into invertible modules for the sphere spectrum. So you have like a spherical vibration or whatever. And so what AVGHR do is they say, let's consider invertible modules for R that don't necessarily come from, you know, this construction applied to a vector bundle. So that the generalization of a vector bundle is a local system of module spectra. And so the point is, like, cohomology classes give you that, even if they don't come from vector bundles. Is that what you were getting at?
Yeah, I think